So we come now to have a look at Paul's beautiful letter to the Ephesians. I'll begin by reading for you some small parts of the Acts of the Apostles, which put this into setting. Paul is writing Romans in the early months, the winter months, of 57 AD. That's highly likely, let's say probable. And as soon as the spring comes, the ships are ready to attack the ocean. And we're told here in the Acts, he was about to set sail for Syria. As he told us in the letter to the Romans, he was going to go to Jerusalem. And he was about to set sail for Syria when a plot was made against him by the Jews. So he decided to return through Macedonia. And it tells you who he was accompanied by, the people taking the collection, you know, from the various churches, elected, back to Jerusalem. We heard about that in 2 Corinthians. So they went ahead and they were waiting for us in Troas. Us has suddenly come back into the Acts of the Apostles. It's in the third person mostly, but waiting for us. So it would appear that he must have gone overland. I'm not sure of that. And he probably went through here, and because it said he was going to go, then he got a boat over to Troas. And there's Troas there, and they were waiting for us at Troas. Now, one of the likely possibilities is that the us is Luke himself. That's the oldest tradition. There's no proof that it's wrong. And while it's highly disputed, it's not been rejected by scholarship. And so I'm working on the obvious assumption, let's put it that way, that it's Luke's writing and the we in it is Luke. And the last time we heard Luke in the Acts using the first person plural we was when he came from Troas over here to Philippi. And we haven't heard of him in the Acts since Philippi, so it may well be that he's at Philippi, Paul goes through here, goes ahead, and then, we're told here, we sailed from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, so it's the Passover. And in 5 days we joined them in Troas where we stayed for 7 days. So here's Paul journeying from Corinth, and we're now in Troas. He tells that rather quaint story. They're having a Eucharist in the evening, and it goes most of the night, and a young man falls out, and they think he might be dead, and Paul goes down and gives him a boot in the ribs, and he screams, and they say he's okay. So they take him up, and etc. Then we went ahead to the ship and set sail for Assos. We, Luke, and whoever's with him. So they come round here by ship for Assos, which was not as easy as it looks in the map. Paul decided, as many others used to decide, apparently to go overland rather than go into the sea there and come round that sometimes dangerous projection into the sea there. So we intended to take Paul on board there, for he had made this arrangement, intending to go by land himself. Then when we met him at Assos, we took him on board and we went to Mytilene, which I think you can see here. And we sailed from there, and on the following day we arrived opposite Chios, the island of Chios. The next day we touched at Samos, and on the day after that we came to Miletus. Miletus here. So they bypassed Ephesus on purpose, he goes on to tell us, because Paul didn't want to drop in there. He wanted to get to Jerusalem by Pentecost. So, because he'd already been delayed much more than he'd hoped. So then there's a beautiful scene here where Paul gives his last speech at Miletus, which is not unrelated to our letter, I think. It's his farewell. He said, "You won't see me again." And they come out onto the sand and they're weeping and they embrace him, and he said, "You won't see my face again." So he leaves then from Miletus here. And then the journey comes, I won't run through it all with you. They journey by boat, Kos, Rhodes, Patara, down here to Caesarea, and then Paul, with the others, goes up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. Halfway, he stays there with, is it Philip and his daughters? I've forgotten. No, it's not. I've forgotten any of the moment who he stays with. And then he goes to Jerusalem with the collection. James and the disciples apparently welcome the collection. That's fine. But they say, look, there's a lot of trouble here. Reputation has come ahead. There's a lot of people after you, which he expected. Remember we did in Romans? He was afraid of the Jews, what might happen to him, and asked the Romans to pray for him. Well, he had good reason to pray, because when he went into the temple, he was there going in on a feast and worshipping, and he'd taken a vow, and he was showing publicly how faithful he was to Judaism. But a mob grabbed him and accused him of taking a Gentile into the temple, which he's not allowed to do. He hadn't done it. It was a false accusation. But there was a big fight. The Romans had to come down and create order. He was taken off then from here to Caesarea for protection. And in Caesarea, he's there for 2 years, awaiting trial. But Felix, the governor, we're told, didn't want a trial, because Felix, we're told, had heard he was expecting a little bit of money. It was known that Paul brought some money from somewhere, and Felix was quite happy to do it as long as he got his cut, and Paul wasn't doing that. So Paul languished here, or languished might be too strong a word, under house arrest at Caesarea for 2 years, till finally he then appeals to Rome. I think you know the story, and goes to Rome. So between 57 and 59 AD, Paul is here at Caesarea, in a sense, with nothing to do. For no good reason, except my whim, I like to think that that's where Paul wrote Ephesus. There's no argument against him writing it there. People don't know where he wrote it from. Some say Rome, some say Ephesus, some say Caesarea. I think I like to present it as his last letter from the East, written to the Gentile communities everywhere here, because he's going away and doesn't expect ever to come back. He's expecting to go to Rome, and from there, as you know, to Spain. So that's where I'm placing the letter for you. Now, this is introduction, of course. It's certainly not written to Ephesus. That's the first surprise that's going to come to you. Because, well, for reasons I'll show you now, it's called a letter to the Ephesians, but it can't be written to Ephesus, for reasons I'll try and explain. Most of the early manuscripts include Ephesus in the title. I'll show you that when we come to verse 1 a little later. But the earliest papyrus codex from about the year 200 AD, a marvellous find, it's called papyrus number 46 by the scholars. It includes most of Paul's writings, practically all of them, little bits left off because of age and that. But in this extraordinarily early papyrus, it doesn't include Ephesus in the title. I'll show you that when we come to it. It's not included in that. Secondly, the two most famous and most important 4th century parchment meaning from the skin of an animal, much more solid stuff and that lasts better, Vaticanus, called so because it's in the Library of the Vatican, and Sinaiticus, because it was discovered there in the late 19th century by Tischendorf and in the monastery of St. Catherine at the foot of Mount Sinai. In fact, he stole it, but he was known to steal quite a bit, this famous German scholar, but everyone's grateful that he stole it. He was there, and they were actually beginning to use it for firewood. They didn't know what they were dealing with. This old stuff, was useless. You get librarians like that who'll throw anything out that hasn't been created in the last 20 years, and they ought to be excommunicated for doing so, but they do. Well, he saw this, so he actually stole it, because he sensed this is more important, and found out, yes, it's the 4th century, and these two, neither of them mention Ephesus in the title. That doesn't prove it's not Ephesus, but it's extraordinary that that be the case. The three most important ancient documents don't include Ephesus. Now, Why may we say that it's not written to the Ephesians? Well, the letter lacks any personal memories. Paul, if he was writing specifically to the Ephesians, you know that he was there for 3 years. It's like impossible that he wouldn't say, give my love to Jack, Mary, Peter, whatever, or talk in a way that showed how familiar he was with them. He doesn't. And he says in the letter, we'll see it, that he's heard about their faith and love. Well, if you were a member of your local parish community and you're writing a letter and you say, look, I heard that you're a very nice group. Well, I mean, you're with us for 10 years, for God's sake, or 3 years, wouldn't you know? Why would you say you've heard about it? Unless it's something a bit distant. An expression he also used in the letter to the Colossians, the same expression, and they were evangelized by Epaphras and not by Paul. So there's every reason in the Colossians 1:4 to say, I've heard about your faith and so on, because he hasn't been there, but he's been to Ephesus. Speaking of his own apostolic commission in this letter, he writes, surely you've heard of our stewardship of God's grace that was given to me for you. You've heard about it. Would you write like that to a community that you'd hardly left and been with for 3 years? Does it sound likely? That's in chapter 3, verse 2. Speaking of Christ, he says in this letter, surely you've heard about him and you were taught in him as truth is in Jesus. I find that a very strange way to write to a familiar community. I think had he been writing to Ephesus, he would have reminded them, remember what I told you, you know, remember what we shared. Not surely you've heard about it, but don't you remember we talked about this again and again and again, don't forget it, or something like that. You'd speak in those kinds of terms. So, it's not written specifically to the Ephesians. I'm going to be suggesting to you that it's a general letter that he wrote there in his confinement in Caesarea, and it's written to the Gentile churches. Of course, a copy will go to Ephesus. It'll be spread around. He'd say, look, take this around to Philippi, Thessalonica, Colossae, all various places. It's his last statement to them of faith and love and what he's... So it's a very general one, so it has to be written in general terms. Quite likely, on the assumption that I'm right so far, why it's called to the Ephesians is it's the copy to the Ephesians that was brought in, because in Ephesus, the early tradition is that's where Paul's letters were gathered towards the end of the first century into, as you might say, a book, a codex, where they were kind of gathered from various places and had time to spread around, and then they become the writings of Paul. Well, the one in it was done in Ephesus. I explained to some of you who are here that might be why that tiny little letter to Philemon is included, because it's about a bloke called Onesimus, remember? And we know that Onesimus actually was the name of the bishop in Ephesus at the end of the first century. It needn't be the same one, but if it is, that would certainly account for its preservation. He's putting in his own little, it's about him, so he sticks it in, and he's got a bishop, he's got to have certain rights. And so he kind of put it in and kept it, their little personal one-page letter. Whatever of that, that's what I'll be suggesting to you. And so in Ephesus is that copy, but it became known as the letter to the Ephesians. I don't know that anyone today would seriously say that it's a specific letter written to the Ephesians. I think the reasons I've given to you are pretty... Now, another problem, however, arises, and that is that this letter may not have been written by Paul. Now, that's quite a common opinion. Probably more than half the scholars that you read will follow that line, that it's not actually Pauline. I don't think I need to go in with you again, do I? Some of you may not have been here, but most of you were, and it's too big an issue to go into that whole question of pseudepigraphy. The main way I'd like to put it to you now is there's nothing theoretically wrong with a letter in the New Testament claiming to be from Paul and not being from Paul. I don't think there are any such. But if there were, it's not a theological problem. And I find the best way to explain it to myself and to you very quickly is, this example strikes me as helpful. You all know about the Jesuits, I'm sure. You know about the founder of the Jesuits, Ignatius Loyola. Well, let us say, after Vatican II, a lot of Jesuits are about half the size they used to be. I'll just close this door. And let's say, well, I'll say I'm standing out the front, say I was the general of the Jesuits, and I wrote a letter to my Jesuit brothers, 14,000 of them, or 20,000, however many there are throughout the world, and wrote the letter, I, Ignatius, and then wrote a letter, which they know I'm writing, but the purpose of saying I, Ignatius, is to... I'm trying to interpret the mind of Ignatius of Loyola for the 21st century. And I'm writing in his style, I'm writing with memories of things that he'd said, and I write as though Ignatius were writing it. Now, when you read it, you, the Jesuits in the world, you might say, oh, you know, he's wrong. Or you might say, wow, he's really picked up Ignatius's spirit beautifully. So you keep it, you copy it, you send it around to your Jesuit mates up in the missions of India or Alaska or somewhere and say, look, we've got this letter, it's terrific, read it. I reckon he's got, you know, what it takes and this is us and that kind of thing. And so that a disciple of Paul would have written a letter and said, I, Paul, you know, later, for a later generation, applying the thoughts of Paul in that style. What that means, of course, is that after a few generations, people forgot that. And then they started to say, Paul wrote it. Well, it is whatever. So I'm not worried about the theoretical problem of pseudepigraphy, and I don't think you should be. But I don't think it's right in this case. That's my argument. The argument that Paul didn't write is given for a number of reasons. I'll go through them with you slowly. And all I'm saying is, from my perspective, and I've just gone into it as fully as I can, and that was pretty fully, I was not convinced by the arguments against Pauline authorship. So since I wasn't convinced by them, and since we've had 2,000 years of tradition saying it was Paul, I think it's up to the people who say it wasn't to prove their case, rather than those who say it was. So let's look at some of the things. The content. That's one of the arguments. They look at the content, and I'll do this with you as we come to each particular piece, and they say, well, this is new. This is not Paul's thought. Paul hasn't used this expression before. My argument against them is, I've written things this year that I haven't written before too. So have you. So has everyone who grows. What's wrong with... Now, if they were inconsistent with Paul's thinking, then you'd have to say, no, this is obviously another person, because Paul couldn't have said it. But that Paul couldn't have grown to say it is not an argument in my view at all. Sitting there 2 years to ponder and think and say his last farewells to the East, why wouldn't he have come to new insights that are growth insights for Paul too? Now, they also argue from the special vocabulary that's found in this. There are words found in Ephesians that Paul hasn't used before. That's getting a bit more serious. But once again, if he's writing, well, you can explain by the general nature of his writing, and the style too. If he's writing to the Ephesians, particularly to the Ephesians, well then you could imagine a lot of things he'd say. Memories, this, that, and say, look now, don't forget what I told you, and I've heard that you've let this go. If he was writing a response letter in response to other letters, can you see there'd be a kind of an engagement? Even in the letter to the Romans, which we've just completed, which is not a letter written to a community he knew, Paul is still engaged in controversy. He's still putting forth his gospel, but to oppose wrong rumours that have been reaching Rome. He's also planning to go to Jerusalem. So there's an argument in it. There's a polemic in it. There's battling for his point of view. You get me? It's kind of, this is nothing to do with it. He's not fighting anybody. He's not arguing for anyone. If I'm right, and I'm sounding a bit persuasive, aren't I? But I'm just giving you what seems to me. That would allow you to write differently. He's writing a big picture. He's writing more poetically. He also begins in this glorious... See, there's big, long sentences, and they say Paul never writes sentences as long as that. That's true. We're going to do one this morning that goes from verse 3 to verse 14. One single sentence. But I've explained to you before that one of the things they learnt in the Stoic schools, anyhow, were different styles of writing. Paul was quite able to write in different styles. And if you're free of polemic, if you're not arguing, if you're not making little points, if you're not answering specific questions, if you're not warning about specific things that could go wrong in a specific church, do you get me? If you're not doing all that, but you're just writing about your faith, why couldn't you write in a prayer style that's meditative and slow and big and contemplative? Why couldn't you? I think you could. People can write prose and poetry, the same person. Paul, there's nothing to say, Paul couldn't write in this style, which is unusual because the letter is unusual. It's the only general letter written without argument to, I think it's his best letter, to present his faith and the gospel that he preaches without any shadows. Now, that Paul is the author... Just to say I'm not a completely maverick position here, it's the conclusion of the 1994 commentary on Colossians. The authors are right on by Barth and Blank. They're writing on Colossians, but in the middle of it they make this statement, and they are of the opinion that Ephesians is actually written by Paul. In 1999, he's one of the teachers, he must be the best of them, they're not all good, P.T. O'Brien is in the Sydney Anglican, what's it called, Moore College. That's where he teaches, and I'd say I've read his commentary, and it's excellent. And that's written in 1999, and it goes through all the scholarship that's up to that date, and he's of the opinion that it's Pauline, written by Paul. So, that's the opinion I'm following. A firm decision, however, on authorship is not essential for an appreciation of this inspired and magnificent letter, which does offer us an excellent overview of a number of Paul's central insights. So if it was written by a disciple, he was a very acute disciple and really picked up Paul's gospel. But since it can't be proved that Paul didn't do it, you'll forgive me for liking the thing that this is Paul doing it. I mean, that's an extra something, isn't there, if you're following a person through in his writings. I think Paul is writing it, and quite capable of writing it, and writes it beautifully. So I'm suggesting that finding himself confined in Caesarea, hearing that the problems he tried to counter in Colossae, because there's a lot of connections between the letter to the Colossians and this letter, probably the problems that were in Colossae, which we studied earlier, some of us, they were growing at this time. It's early Gnosticism kind of beginning. So probably he's now more aware that this is not just Colossae, these different philosophical problems were occurring in, but it's spreading in that area. So that becomes a key focus of the writing. So he uses a lot of, not quoting, but a lot of the thoughts that he actually wrote specifically to Colossae and asked them to share with Laodicea. He's now including in this magnificent tapestry of gospel writing before he moves away from the East forever and starts his mission.